It was out of view. He stood up, waited 5 more minutes, then stepped through the door. Everything was just as it had been. There was the same deep, muffled quiet. No wind from outside rattled the mirrored windows. Nothing moved, or almost nothing. There was an unnerving flicker at the corner of his eye, like a television left on without the sound. It was the mirror in the bathroom, where flakes of snow were still drifting down. He stood at the top of the stairs, swung his arms, and bounced on his toes. He had not even a glimmer of a plan. How did you turn a monster back into a person? It took a long time for Alice to appear again, and he was starting to wonder if he should call her name when he heard a muffled, fumbling clatter in the room below, like somebody kicking something small and heavy across a rug. A minute later, that thin blue radiance came filtering up the stairwell. Whatever he'd been about to do or say or cast exited his head, and he got up and walked stiff-legged back to the door. He couldn't stop himself. It was like his legs were bionic and somebody else was controlling them. That was what it was to fear for your life. He stopped himself in front of the door, breathing hard, not quite going through, not yet. What was he going to do? He wanted to shout at her, "Wake up! Remember who you are! I need to talk to Alice!" But the thing about monsters was you couldn't talk to them about it, because they wouldn't admit they were monsters in the first place. She came rising up right through the floor. Quentin bounded away from the door, out of the room, and down the stairs like an athlete. He heard laughter, creepily familiar. It was hers, but cold, musical, mechanical, somebody tapping on a wine glass. She came floating down the stairs after him, and he backed away into the mirror version of Plum's bedroom. He caught a glimpse of her. She wasn't quite Alice, not exactly. She blurred out for a second, a low-res hologram of herself. Her hair floated weightless around her head. And she never stopped smiling. Never. Blue lips. Blue teeth. Maybe it was fun being a Niffin. Maybe everybody had the wrong idea about it. She followed him down to the first floor, through the dining room and back up the stairs, back down, back up, then back up to the third floor. She didn't hurry, though when he hurried up, so did she, as if that were one of the rules of the game. It might have been comical if he weren't being chased by a blue demon who could burn him to nothing just by touching him, and probably without touching him. Sometimes she paid attention to the walls and the floors and the ceilings. Sometimes she passed through them with no resistance. Maybe the weirdest thing about this surreal duel was that he was starting to enjoy it. However distorted or transmuted she was still Alice. He was spending time with her. She was pure magic now, pure rage and power, but he had always loved her rage and her power. Those were two of the greatest things about her. She wasn't Alice, but she wasn't quite not Alice either. At this rate, he could stay ahead of her forever as long as he avoided dead ends. It was like he was a ghost, he thought giddily, and she was Pac-Man, or the other way around. Though no, Pac-Man could eat the ghosts when they were blue. Never mind, focus. He wondered how long till she lost patience and went for him. It was like swimming with sharks, except that he knew what sharks wanted. He couldn't guess within a million miles what Alice wanted. There were moments when he wanted to throw himself at her, right into her arms, and let her burn him up in an instant. What an incredibly stupid fucking idea. After half an hour of this, he doubled back through the red door, back home. This wasn't getting them anywhere. He sat on the edge of the work table, gasping a little from all the stair climbing. He was still alive, but he wasn't making progress. Some way or other, he was doing this wrong. He was still there when Plum came up around 7 with coffee. "Jesus," she said, "are you playing chicken with that thing?" "With Alice," he corrected her automatically. I guess I am. How's it going?
Pretty well, Quentin said. I'm not dead.
And Alice?
She's still dead. Plum nodded.
I don't mean to sound at all critical, she said, but maybe you should just leave this alone. Stop tempting fate. I feel weird just being in the same house with it. Her.
I want to learn about her.
What have you got so far?
Not much. She likes to play. She could have killed me by now, but she hasn't.
Christ! Quentin!
They both watched the open doorway like it was a TV or a hole through which they were ice fishing.
It's weird to think that she killed my great-great-uncle Martin, Plum said. But then it sounds like she had her reasons. Is she really alive in there?
I don't know. It feels like she is.
Okay, I'll leave you to it.
Plum paused in the doorway. I know you're going to get obsessed with this, so try not to forget the big picture. If there's no hope, you have to promise me you'll let her go.
She was right, of course.
Where did she get off being wiser than him at 21?
I'll let it go. I promise. Just not yet.
I'll leave you alone.
I'm not alone, Quentin said. Alice is here.
Later that day, he tried fighting her. He'd watched Alice face down Martin Chatwin himself with a whole arsenal of magic that he'd never seen before, but that was a long time ago. Now he knew his way around a ward and shield or two. He could chuck a magic missile with the best of them. It was a damn one-man magic missile crisis. And Alice was playing with him. This was a game to her. Quentin had this advantage, at least. He wasn't playing. It made him feel sick, fighting somebody he wanted to love. But right now, Alice was in no condition to love or be loved. He looked up the thickest, baddest-ass shielding spell he knew about and crudely attached a couple of hardening enhancements to it. Taking a deep breath, he stepped through the closet door and, as quickly as he could, cast the shield 6 times in a row, one after the other, 6 magic shields hanging invisibly in the air in front of him, or all but invisibly. Looking through 6 of them at once turned the air a little rosy pink. Any more than 6, and they would have started to interfere with each other, diminishing returns. Plus, he didn't think he could do another one right now, anyway. Then the missiles. He'd made them in advance, with all the trimmings. Treble weight, electrically charged, armor-piercing, viciously poisoned. He wouldn't have dared to even prep the spell on Earth, let alone cast it, if the house hadn't itself been so heavily shielded. If he missed, they'd go through the wall like paper, plus they were a long way from street legal. Technically, he was going to cast them in another dimension, so maybe he'd get off on jurisdictional grounds. Alice rose to meet him. Feeding time. She never quite touched the ground, he noticed, though when she saw him noticing, she gave a little kick with her legs, balletic almost, a joke, as if to say, "Remember when I used to walk with these things? Sure you do. Remember when I used to spread them for you, my darling?" Quentin tried to kill her. He knew he couldn't, but he thought she might feel it, and as long as she was a Niffin, this was virtually the only interaction they could have together. He cast the magic missiles, full strength, and then some. They practically took his fingertips off. They were green, seething things that darted at Alice like hungry fish. But about 10 feet from her, they slowed to a crawl. She looked at them, pleased, as if Quentin had made her cookies. You shouldn't have. Under her gaze, the missiles lost the courage of their convictions. They formed a line, single file, and obediently encircled her waist in a sparking, fizzing green ring. Then the ring burst out in all directions. 2 of the missiles whanged resonantly off Quentin's sextuple shield. He flinched. He wouldn't have survived even one of them. Then Alice was across the room and hanging in the air right in front of him. He couldn't tell if she'd teleported or just darted straight at him. She was that fast. For the first time, she looked pissed off. She bared her sapphire teeth. Was it being a Niffin that made her this angry? Or had she been this angry all along? Maybe the rage had been inside her already, and becoming a Niffin had just revealed it, burned away the protective shielding. Either way, she was Alice to the life. He'd know her anywhere. She was more than alive. She was humming and crackling with energy. Her eyes were the brightest, angriest, most magnificently amused eyes he'd ever seen. She reached out and put a hand on the first of his six shields, pressed on it with two blue fingertips, then put them through it. The shield flared and died. The second shield buzzed angrily when she touched it. That should have killed her, too. He'd laced it with a magical charge he'd only read about and in a book he shouldn't have been reading. She wiggled her fingers with sensual pleasure. Delightful! With both hands, she grasped the third shield and picked it up. Set it aside as if it were a physical object, an old picture frame maybe, and leaned it against a wall. It was a joke. Magic didn't even work that way, but if you were a Niffin, it worked however you wanted it to. She did the same thing with the next one, and the next, stacking them neatly, like folding chairs. Quentin didn't wait around for the ending. He could see where this was heading. Seeding the field of battle, he stepped back through the doorway. Let her follow him if she could, but she couldn't. It was hard and smooth as glass to her. She mushed her face and her breasts against the barrier, like a kid squishing her face against a window, and looked at him with one antic eye, blue on blue. She was daring him, baiting him. Come on, quit moping around. Don't you want to have some fun? When she opened her mouth, it was bright inside, like in a photographic negative. Alice, Quentin said. Alice! He closed the red door. He'd seen enough. She was the mad woman in the attic. It was weirdly intimate, this one-sided duel. Just her and him, one-on-one. Not like sex, but intimate. He was like a free diver trying for greater and greater depths, forcing himself down, lungs bursting, then kicking frantically for the surface with his puny human flippers, the big blue nipping at his heels. Quentin kept records of his trips in a spiral notebook. Where he went, where she went, what he'd done, what she'd done. There wasn't much point to it, because the performance went more or less the same way every time, but it helped him fight off sadness. And he did notice one thing. Alice liked to herd him toward the front door of the house, like she was daring him to open it. That seemed like a dare he'd be better off not taking. But if there was nothing else on offer, their little dance was like the end game of a disastrously bloody chess match. Just a queen chasing a beleaguered king around an empty board, sadistically refusing to checkmate him. It was difficult to know what, if anything, was going on in the queen's mind, but one thing was clear. Alice was better at this game than he was. Apart from everything else, she knew him better than he knew himself. She always had. So that night, close to midnight, when Plum was safely in bed, he reversed tactics again. Alice wanted him to open the front door. He was going to head straight for it. Give her what she wants. See what she does with it. He still didn't know what he was looking for, but maybe he'd find out what she was looking for. He prepped a couple of spells in advance and cast the first one as soon as he'd stepped through the door. It created a reasonably lifelike image of him in every room of the house. It didn't confuse her, but it might have pissed her off, because Quentin barely made it to the stairs before she banished the illusion so harshly that he felt like somebody had scrubbed his brain with steel wool. Go on or go back. In an undignified panic, he fainted for the stairs,
dodged past Alice at close quarters, arching his body like a bullfighter, and locked himself in the half-bathroom off the landing. Now he'd trapped himself, but good. He fumbled in his pocket and whipped out a Sharpie he'd been keeping on him in case of emergency. Scribbling at top speed, he wrote an inscription in Swahili across the door, then sketched a big rectangle around the whole frame, with fiddly ornaments at the corners, all executed in one unbroken line. It was just a ward to insulate against magic, because, he reasoned hopefully, Alice was made of magic now. It was all he could think of. The door shook with an impact, bulged visibly inward, air puffing in around the edges as if a grenade had gone off behind it. It held, but immediately it began warping in its frame, and the paint started to blister. It wasn't going to hold for long. It wasn't meant to be a magic barrier. It just wanted to be a bathroom door. He turned around, and his eye fell on the medicine cabinet mirror, in which it continued to snow. Experimentally, he put a hand through it. No resistance. Another portal. He put one foot on the toilet, planted his knee on the sink, and fed himself through the narrow opening. It was cold in the other bathroom, the other bathroom. He crawled desperately down off the sink and half fell onto the bathroom floor, which was slick with slush. Where was he now? Two worlds removed from reality now, a land within a land, another level down. What would he do when the door failed? He might be able to slip past her again, get back through. But then what had he gained? He didn't want to leave empty-handed, not again. This free diver was going to touch bottom, even if it meant he wasn't coming back up. There must be something interesting down here. At this depth, maybe some of the rules would start breaking down. Slipping and sliding to his feet, he half-walked, half-skated out into the hall and into the mirror image of the mirror image of the workroom. The lights were out in this one, and he hastily summoned some illumination. The palms of his hands glowed like flashlights. Something was different here. He could almost feel the increased pressure of the multiple layers of reality above him. This land was heavier somehow, like it had been put through a photo filter that saturated the colors and made the black lines thicker and darker. It tried to push into his eyes and ears. He couldn't stay here long. But where to? He went over to the windows and heaved one up and open. The street was recognizably their street, or almost. There was a road and street lights, but there were no other houses. It was like a desert housing development that had suffered some financial calamity just as construction began. All around, in the distance, cold sand slid silkily, hissing, over more cold sand. It was night, and instead of light, the street lights poured down rain as if they were weeping. The sky was black, no stars, and the moon was flat and silver, a mirror reflecting a ghost earth. This wasn't something he was supposed to see. It was an unfinished sketch of a world, a set that hadn't been properly dressed. He shut the window. This workroom had a red door, too. He opened it and stepped through. Now he was getting close to the heart of something. He could feel it. Three levels down, the innermost chamber, the littlest Russian doll, a tiny wooden peg with smeary features, barely a doll at all. This room looked nothing like anything in the townhouse, but he recognized it anyway. The hushed carpet, that warm, fruity smell. A stranger's house that he'd only been in once, and that for about 15 minutes, but it was like he'd never left it. He was back in Brooklyn. 13 years ago, back at the house where he'd come for his Princeton interview. It was like he was burrowing deeper into his own mind, back in time, back into his memory. This was where it all began. Maybe if he stuck around, he could finally have his interview after all. He could go back and get his master's degree.
Was this really it, or just a simulacrum? Was there another, younger Quentin, waiting just outside the door, getting even more depressed than usual as he stood there, fretting in the cold rain? And his friend James, young and strong and bravo? The loops were getting stranger, the timelines were in a Gordian knot, the thick was plottened beyond all recognition. Or was this a second chance? Was this how to fix her? Change it all so it never happened? Rip up the envelope and walk away? He heard the sound of cracking wood a long way off in another reality. Two realities up. Last time he was here, he went for the liquor cabinet. Lesson learned. He looked around. Yes, a grandfather clock, just like in Christopher Plover. It was so obvious now. He opened the case. It was full of shining golden coins. They poured out onto the floor like a Vegas jackpot. They were like Mayakovsky's coins, but there must have been hundreds of them. God, the amount of power here was unthinkable. What couldn't you do with it? He had his masters now. He was a master magician. He could fix Alice. He could fix anything. He stuffed his pockets with them. Speaking of whom, Alice came drifting through the doorway behind him, slow rolling languorously onto her back like an otter. Time to go. He juked past her and back through the door the other way. In the workroom, the snow was turning to rain, and the parquet had an inch of gray slush on it, and he half fell sprinting across it, his pockets heavy with treasure. He slammed shut the bathroom door, but then fumbled the Sharpie and dropped it. No time. He spat out a spell that doubled his speed and scrambled up and over the sink and felt the hot prickle of way too much magic, way too close on his trailing ankle. Alice was a blue blur behind him, and he wasn't faster than she was, but he was fast enough, just, to make it back across the landing and through the workroom and the red door, and out into the real world. She hadn't gotten him. Not today. Not today. He stood there for a minute, puffing and blowing and pulling himself together, hands on his knees. Then he dug his hands in his pockets and spilled the gold out on the table. Show 'em what they've won. He should have known. It was fairy gold, like in the stories, the kind that turns to dead leaves and dried flowers when the sun comes up. That's what he'd found. The coins had turned to ordinary nickels. It was never going to be that easy. This wasn't working. There had to be another way. He needed sleep. His ankle was starting to burn where his close call with Alice had scorched it. Quentin! Elliot was standing in the doorway, looking in his Philorian court finery like he'd just detached himself from a Hans Holbein painting. He held a tumbler from the kitchen in one hand, full of whiskey, which he raised in greeting. "You look like you've just seen a ghost," he said. Chapter 23 Quentin hugged him so hard that Elliot spilled his whiskey down his front, which he complained about loudly, but Quentin didn't care. He had to make sure Elliot was real and solid. It made no sense that he was here, but thank God he was. Quentin had had enough of sadness and horror and futility for one day. He needed a friend, somebody who knew him from the old days. And seeing Elliot here, out of the blue, for no reason whatsoever, felt like proof that impossible things were still possible. He needed that, too. "It's good to see you," he said. "You too." "You met Plum?"
"Yes. Charming girl. I assume you're..."
"No," Quentin said.
"Not even..."
"No." Elliot shook his head sadly.
"I can see I came not a minute too soon."
They stayed up late, filling each other in on everything that had happened. Then they slept late and drank too much coffee and went over it all again. Elliot's news brought Quentin up short and sharp. Whether or not he was in it, whether or not he could see it or touch it, He'd thought there would always be a fillery out there somewhere. He loved knowing it was there. It anchored his sense of happiness, the way a distant stockpile of gold might underwrite the value of a paper bill. It was inconceivably sad to think of it ending. And where would they all go? All the people and animals and everything else. What would happen to them? "But you think there might be something here that could save it," he said. "Something Rupert had?" Elliot paced around the living room in circles. Plum and Quentin sat on separate couches, watching him. While they slept, he'd been up even later, going through Rupert's notebook. He'd been excited at first when he realized that his search had converged with theirs. He'd come to Earth on a quest, and his best friend had already done it for him. But he'd gone back to being frustrated. "Maybe it was the knife, but what would I do with it? Who would I stab with it? I never know who to stab. But I don't know what to do with the spell, either." "It's not for reviving a dead land," Quentin said. "It's for making somewhere new." "There must be something else in that manuscript, then, a clue or something. And why would the bird want it?" As urgent as this was, Quentin's mind was still with Alice upstairs. Part of him wanted to snap into hero mode, to leap to Fillory's defense. But saving Fillory was Elliot's business now. It was hard to admit it, but it was true. He would do what he could, but right now his job was Alice.
"But so Martin made his deal with Umber?" Elliot said finally. "I thought Umber was good. And then didn't Martin kill Umber?"
"He still could have," Quentin said. "The classic double cross."
"Or maybe Umber's still alive somewhere. Maybe we're just supposed to think he's dead."
"Ooh, I like that one," Plum said. "How do you even know Martin killed Umber? God, I still can't believe I'm talking about them like they're real people, or animals, or gods, or whatever."
"Ember told Jane Chatwin," Quentin said. "Jane told me. But you're right. Maybe this is all Umber's fault. Maybe he's the hidden hand, or hoof, or whatever, behind the apocalypse."
"But why?" Elliot rubbed his face with both hands. "Why would he do that? How can he be alive? Where's he been all this time? How can he be evil? What, is he Ember's evil twin? It's a bit of a cliché, even for Fillory."
Buckets of sunlight were pouring over-enthusiastically in through the bay windows. It was claustrophobic in the house. Quentin hadn't been outside for days. As tired as he'd been, he hadn't slept well the night before. It was hard knowing that Alice was right there, burning, always burning, with just a thin slip of world between them. He wondered if Alice ever slept. He didn't think she did.
"And Castle Blackspire?" Elliot was getting more and more animated. "What's that? It screws up the entire structure. Where does it end? Umber's got to be the key, one way or the other. Got to. That must be the clue Jane wanted us to find."
Coming to the end of his caffeine fit, he dropped bonelessly into a vinyl armchair.
"I'm going to send a message to Janet. She should know about this."
"You can do that? Send a message to Fillory?"
"It's not easy, kind of like a very expensive telegram. But yeah, R.H.I.P. Let's talk about something else. What have you learned about your dead girlfriend?"
"She's not dead," Quentin said.
"Bzzzt!"
Elliot pressed an imaginary game show button on the arm of the chair. "The answer I was looking for was, she's not my girlfriend, she's a crazy magic rage demon. Maybe you should just take the land apart, scrub it out, cut your losses."
"What, with Alice inside?"
"Well, she'll survive, probably. You can't kill those things. She'll just go back where she came from."
"But she's still alive, Elliot, and she's right there, right there. If there was ever, ever going to be a chance to change her back, this is it."
"Quentin, don't Quentin me." Now he was the one getting animated. "This is what I'm doing, what I have to do. You're saving Fillory, I'm doing this."
"Quentin, look at me. Elliot sat up. You're right. If there was ever a chance, this would be it. But there isn't a chance. That's not Alice. Alice is already dead. She died 7 years ago, and you can't bring her back. I went to the underworld. She wasn't there. You didn't see her, but that doesn't mean she wasn't there. We've been over and over this. Quentin, I could really use your help. Fillory needs your help. And I hate to be crass, you know I do, but Alice is one person. We're talking about Fillory, all of it, the entire land, thousands of people, plus a lot of cute animals.
I know. They were wasting time. He had to get back upstairs.
I know, but I have to try.
What's your plan there? Plum said.
I don't know. Run around some more, cast some more spells. Maybe I'll stumble on something. Trial and error.
Plum tapped her lips with one finger.
Not my place, but it sounds to me like you're a little stuck.
I am stuck.
It sounds to me, she said, like you're dicking around, sneaking, dodging, avoiding confrontation.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I just don't know what else to do.
Against my better judgment, Plum said, I'm going to give you the benefit of a woman's perspective on this one.
I am so excited to see where this is going, Elliot said. I can't even tell you. Keep talking.
What I mean is, meet her head on. Stand and fight. Quit sneaking around. See what happens.
I tried that. I lost.
It sounds to me like you tried hiding behind like 90 shields, Plum said. That shit probably just pissed her off even more, and from what I've seen, she was already plenty pissed. You know what makes people angry? When they're trying to tell you something and you're not hearing them. Then they feel like they have to get louder and louder and louder, and then you're still not listening. You're just getting all scared.
Because it's fucking scary.
She wants you to stand and face her, Quentin. What I'm talking about is walking in there and dealing with her. You want her to be a person again? Try treating her like one.
Quentin shook his head. That's suicide.
Is it? It sounds to me like a relationship.
You're being glib, he said.
Am I? Why hasn't she killed you yet?
A heavy silence fell in the room.
The trouble was that she was right. However Alice got here, it wasn't an accident. He'd tried to make a land, and it hadn't worked. He'd wanted to create something, make something new, be somebody new, but it was becoming apparent that he couldn't. Not until he'd dealt with something old, not until he'd cleared his debts and laid his ghosts to rest. The way he really knew Plum was right was that it was what Alice would have done.
I still think you should scrub it out, Elliot said, obviously disappointed.
Fresh beginning. Start over.
I have a feeling, Plum said, that it's a little bit late in the day to start over.
Back in the fourth-floor workroom, Quentin opened the red door again. He was starting to hate the sight of his land. It was a stillborn thing. He'd meant to make something fresh and real, and instead he'd produced this cold, sterile photocopy. Something had gone wrong, and more he was starting to think that the problem was him. He sat down at the work table and stared at his notes, thinking about what Plum had said and waiting for some kind of signal to emerge out of the noise. Should he just walk in, stand there, look her in the eye? Maybe he should. There she was, right there in the doorframe, watching him as if she knew what he was thinking.
I'm here, he said.
Alice, it's time we talked. It's time we figured this out.
She floated there, free falling in place, staring right through him. Something was missing. If they were going to talk, and if it was going to count, it should be here in the real world, not the copy. He wanted to bring her through, to force her out into the open, onto his ground.
It would be a terrible risk. A niffin in lower Manhattan. If he lost control, he could be looking at a magical September 11th. But you could talk yourself out of anything. Come here.
Could she?
Come out here. Let's finish this.
Faint smile, but nothing more. Alice couldn't or wouldn't come through on her own. That meant he had to help her. He began with a series of erasures and banishments and anti-magic attacks, each one more powerful and violent than the next. But the land was tougher than it looked. They didn't scratch it. It wasn't going that easily, not without a fight. He changed tacks. He picked up his staff, his lovely black wood and silver staff. It took 5 tries, whacking it against the brick pillars in the workroom, but he broke it in the middle and then twisted apart the 2 halves. And even then, the land persisted. Alice looked like she was enjoying the show. Maybe this wasn't a question of brute force. He walked up to the threshold and stood 6 inches away. Closing his eyes, he willed the land to go away. He imagined it giving up, surrendering its existence, letting its cold substance dissolve as if it had never been. It never should have been. It didn't want to be. Let go. Yes. He opened his eyes. Out, brief candle, he said, and blew softly. 1 puff. The mirror house collapsed from the outside in. There was a moment of silence. Quentin imagined the cold, sandy outskirts dispersing outside, the raining streetlights ceasing to be. Then came a distant bang as the lower floors began contracting like an accordion. Quentin backed up as far as the doorway. Alice looked over her shoulder. If a niffin could disbelieve, there was disbelief on her face. Then the banging came closer, and finally the room behind her shut like a trash compactor, and she was shoved rudely through the doorway into reality. When she turned to face him again, there was a new seriousness of purpose on her face. She wasn't playing anymore, either. Quentin called down the stairwell. Guys! Plum! Alice smiled at him as if to say, sure, go on and call your little girlfriend. It's not like that. As she passed the table, her fingers brushed it and it began to burn. He backed down the stairs gingerly, never taking his eyes off her as if she were a wild animal. Plum, he called.
Elliot! Alice is out! I collapsed the land and she came through!
He heard Plum stir in her room.
What?
She opened her door in a sweatshirt, hair loose, and saw Alice at the top of the stairs. She must have been taking a nap.
Oh. Was that a good idea?
Probably.
Elliot!
Where was the high fucking king? What was weird was Quentin wasn't afraid. Usually in moments of crisis he was lost in a swarm of choices, paralyzed by the possibility that he might do the wrong thing. There were so many wrong things to do, and so few right ones. But not this time. This time the through line was clear to him. There was only one right option, and it could be fatal, but death would be preferable to a life spent doing either the wrong thing or nothing at all.
Plum, get behind me.
She did, for a wonder, and together they retreated downstairs to the living room where he tried to stall Alice by blocking off the doorway. Kinetic magic, crude, but he had to try it. He threw together a barrier out of books, dishes from the kitchen, the pillows from the sofa, whatever he could get a magical grip on, but she passed right through them, and where she touched them, they burned.
Quentin! Plum said, this is my house, that I own. Don't break it.
She put the fires out, but the air smelled like burning insulation.
Plum, you have to get out of here, he said quietly. Find Elliot and go.
Whatever he was going to do, he couldn't do it if he was worrying about Plum, too.
He couldn't hold back, and his control wasn't going to be good. In fact, if he was lucky, his control would be really, really bad. It was going to end here one way or the other. He was going to fix Alice, or he was going to die trying. She'd died for him once already. He couldn't do any less for her. An experiment. He brought his hands together, laced his fingers, and all the electrical cords in the room made for Alice like striking snakes. It was a trick he couldn't have pulled off before his father had died, but he carried that extra strength with him now. Current flowed, the lights browned out, and Alice's blue aura flickered. Quentin smelled melting plastic. Alice slitted her eyes with pleasure. What next? He'd already tried magic missiles. A magnetic cage, maybe. No? Just force, then. Wards, shields, thick, invisible layers of power, one after the other, like he'd done when he was working on the page, wrapping around her and then contracting and then having the next one wrapped around it. Light refracted and bent around Alice, producing incidental distortions and rainbows. The spells shed little orbital sparks and streamers. He felt her pushing, probably with a tiny fraction of her strength, but she hadn't burst through yet. The mere fact that she felt resistance was progress. Maybe it was love or courage or the plastic fumes, but Quentin felt strength building up in him, a rising, cresting flood of it. He'd felt this way once before in Fillory on Benedict Island, and even farther back, that first night at Breakbills, when it had all come tearing out of him for the first time. But he was even stronger now. It felt good. Not much time left. Thank God the building was already warded up tight, because he could feel the energy in the room pressing at the walls, bulging them outward, threatening to blow out the windows. Alice shoved harder at the envelope of force, frowning. His eyes flicked around the room for anything metal, found the bare steel frame of the couch, jerked it to him with a magnetic spell. Amping up his strength, toughening his hands, he bent it into the shape of an arch with 2 feet, an omega. It was almost too late. Like tearing tissue paper, Alice was through her prison and on him. Her blue hands gripped the sigil just above his, but she couldn't get past it. Their faces were close together now. She was smiling as usual, showing her perfect sapphire teeth, as if she could barely keep from laughing her head off. Quentin smiled back. This, at last, was right. He was meeting her head-on, like Plum said, strength to strength. He braced one leg behind him. No more skulking around in shadow worlds. This was real. He could feel the power of her, the buzz and snap of it. Could she feel him, too? God, it was a relief to let go, to completely lose his shit and give it everything he had, and find out once and for all if it was enough. "Is that all, Alice?" he said. "Is that it? I want more. Give me everything." The metal glowed red and white around their hands now. Instead of shielding or hardening his own hands, he made them metal, too. He borrowed the steel of the couch frame and drew it into them. They started to glow as he dumped more and more of his precious energy into keeping the ward going and keeping himself from catching on fire. He was going to beat this thing, this magical abomination that had Alice trapped inside it. He was going to pry it open and pull her out like the jaws of fucking life. His magician's sixth sense warned him just as the balance shifted. This thing was going critical. His omega was steel, but at the end of the day it was only a couch frame, and he was asking more of it than it had to give. He managed one last shield, this one just around himself. Then he let go. The metal glyph exploded into vapor in Alice's hands. The blast pushed them apart. He skidded backward a few feet across the living room floor. He let it all drop. His shield evaporated. His hands and arms were flesh again. It was just him and her, nothing between them, just empty air and silence and 7 years of lost time. All through the fight, he'd kept expecting himself to panic, but the panic never came. and now he knew it wouldn't. The old Quentin might have done it, but he wasn't a creature of fear anymore, jumping at his own shadow, never knowing who he was or why. When he was younger, it seemed like the only time he wasn't afraid was when he was angry. He'd been so full of fear and self-doubt that the only way he could think of to be strong was to attack the world around him. But that wasn't real strength. He understood that now. They'd both come so far to be here. He was getting a second chance, and he wasn't going to miss it.
"You," she said.
"I'm not the boy you used to know, Alice," he said. "Not anymore. That boy is gone. I know who I am now, but you don't know me." A great warm calm was in him, welling up out of the hidden reservoir where it had been waiting all this time, if only he'd known where to find it. Alice's eyes narrowed. She hung back, suspicious, studying him. Quentin began pulling his shirt off, started unbuttoning it, and then just tore it off. It was time to go all in. He nearly missed his chance. Having decided evidently that Quentin was bluffing, Alice went for him, and this time she was coming to kill him. He turned away and shouted a word he hadn't heard since he was 21. He didn't know if Alice was technically a demon or not, but either way he had an empty demon trap tattooed on his back, and he was going to use it. It was all he had left. He didn't see it happen, but there was a great inrush of air, like a giant gasping in surprise, and Alice cried out angrily, "No! No!" And he heard the cry go up an octave and then cut off sharply. Then the room was silent, and he was alone except for drifting motes of couch fluff in the air. At the same moment, his tattoo lit up with cold fire. It was like somebody had dumped liquid nitrogen on his back. When Fogg put a cacodemon in his back the night before graduation, he'd felt nothing at all. But this wasn't nothing. This hurt. And there was pressure inside him, massive pressure. He couldn't breathe. He groaned like a woman in labor, trying to let some of it out, but it only got worse. He could feel Alice in there. He felt her rage and her power, and something like ecstasy. Quentin pressed his back against the coolness of the wall to try to ease the burning, but it did nothing. He felt like his rib cage was cracking. The veins were glowing in the backs of his hands. The front door slammed open. "What did you do? Where's Alice?" Plum and Elliot were staring at him. They'd burst in, ready for the fight of their lives. "And you took your shirt off," Plum added.
"She's in my back," he whispered.
He couldn't speak any louder.
"I know."
He detached himself from the wall and began walking stiffly up the stairs. Sweat was starting out across his forehead, trickling down his chest.
"You should go," he whispered.
"What are you doing?" Plum asked, but he couldn't even answer her. He could feel Alice stirring inside him like a genie in her lamp. She wanted out by whatever exit she could find or make. In his mind, he was putting things together, doing back-of-the-envelope calculations, and then ignoring the answers when they weren't reassuring. "What are you doing?" Plum shouted after him.
"Come on," Elliot said. "We have to help him."
They followed him up. He couldn't stop them, and Elliot was right. He needed their help. He climbed the stairs to the fourth-floor workroom, the skin on his back sore and stretched tight like a third-degree sunburn.
"Coins," he whispered. "Mayakovsky's."
There was enough room here. The spell came to him easily, automatically, like it had worn a deep channel right down the middle of him, even though he was casting it for the first time. He could see the page from the Netherlands in front of him in his mind, the columns of numbers, the turning orbits that spun around each other like a magician juggling rings, the plant with its long leaves rustling demurely in a wind from somewhere out of frame. He knew the whole thing by heart. Until now, he just hadn't understood why. This was what it was for. This was why he'd snatched it out of the air and saved it. Matter and magic.
He'd thought it was about making matter magical, but now he had something that was pure magic, and he was going to give it matter, reverse the flow. He was going to bring Alice back into the world of the physical. He snapped out orders. There was no time to be polite, and Plum and Elliot handed him things as he called for them. Powders, liquids, books open to such and such a page, one of the gold coins. He took them without looking, like a surgeon up to his elbows in a patient. It was like he'd been assembling the pieces without knowing it. He couldn't have done it without his newfound strength, and not without minor mendings either. He knew, had always known, how to knit broken things together. He scraped at his insides for every last scintilla of magical strength. He was feverish, his body temperature was rising scarily, and his knees felt like they could buckle at any moment, but his mind was clear. He knew what he had to do if he could just stay upright long enough. When everything was complete, when the enchantment was hovering latent in the air like a thundercloud about to burst, he turned his back to the room and opened the trap. It was like letting out an enormous breath that he'd been holding for way too long. The room flooded with blue light, the light in a swimming pool on a summer afternoon. Quentin almost blacked out with the relief of it. Later he would look at his tattoo and find a raised, blackened scar in the center of the star. Alice's blue form was floating limp in the center of the room, on its back, listless but stirring. She wasn't smiling now, not at all. Her expression when she focused on him was black. She was angry, a wasp who'd been trapped in a jar and then shaken, and she was ready to sting. She was the most beautiful, terrible thing he'd ever seen, like an acetylene flame, an incandescent filament, a fallen star right in front of him. He met her gaze and held it, and spoke a word in a language so old that the linguists of the world believed it to be lost and forgotten forever. But magicians had not forgotten. Mayakovsky's coin, the second coin, flared in his hand, and he forced himself to grip it tight, even though it felt like a fistful of molten gold or dry ice, like his fingers must be melting or blackening and curling up. Alice startled as if she'd heard a sound. Not his voice, but something else, something far off, a distant church bell tolling at dawn. Then the air around her darkened, and the world began falling into her. It had begun. The spell was pulling atoms from the room around her. Her skin darkened and became dull and opaque. She writhed as particles swarmed around her like insects, embedding themselves in her form. Matter rushed at her, crowded into her, substituting crude substance for her luminous, translucent blue flesh. Quentin stumbled back, and Plum and Elliot caught him, and together they staggered out through the doorway. It wouldn't do to be too close, to have any of their atoms pulled into Alice. The spell would do it if it had to. The spell didn't care. Alice was convulsing now, growing heavier, condensing out of the air, being forcibly embodied. She moaned, a deep agony moan, already half-human. Her niffin light was fading. She sounded like she was dying, and for a horrific second, Quentin wondered if he'd been wrong, if he was killing her instead of saving her. But it was too late to take it back. When it was finished, the blue was all gone. Alice fell to the wooden floor with a dull smack, hard enough to bounce once and lie still. The room reeked of rarefied gases, sharp spikes in his nostrils. Alice lay sprawled on the floor on her back, her eyes closed, breathing shallowly. She was flesh again. The old Alice. Human Alice, pale and real and naked. He knelt down next to her. Her eyes opened, just barely, narrowed against the light.
"Quentin," she said hoarsely. You changed your hair.
Chapter 24.
Listen up, everybody. I got a letter from Elliot. Janet felt comfortable in Elliot's chair in the meeting room in Castle Whitespire. She could have conducted business from her own official chair, but she liked Elliot's. It didn't look different from the other thrones, but there was something about it that felt more pleasant, accommodating. Power, she supposed it was. It suits me.
Point of order, Josh said. Are you, like, High Queen now, like, with Elliot gone?
Was she?
Sure, why not?
It's just...
Your constitutional arguments are kind of de trop at this exact moment, Josh. Also, I wrote most of the Constitution, so you will definitely lose them. All of them.
Josh opened his mouth.
Bup, bup, bup!
Do you want to hear the letter or not?
Yes,
Josh and Poppy said together. Then they gave each other a loathsome little miniature married smile.
Sure,
Poppy added.
Their deaths would be awesome. I mean, the balcony was right there. But hard to justify politically.
Janet moved on. For now.
It goes like this. She held up the little paper tape like a ticker tape. Or a fortune cookie fortune. Thick plottens stop. Umber was slash is evil. And maybe alive stop. Who knew, right? Stop. Find him ASAP stop. Might save world stop. Try under northern marsh maybe stop. Back soonest kiss stop.
There was silence in the room.
That's it, Poppy said.
You were expecting,
I don't know, something a bit more formal, maybe?
He doesn't even say hi to us,
Josh said.
No. Other questions?
Does he really have to do it like that? Like a telegram?
No, not really. I think he just enjoys it.
Any questions of a more substantive nature?
Josh and Poppy shared another marital glance.
I don't know how to phrase this exactly, but what the fuck?
Josh said. Umber's not evil, or wasn't evil. He was Ember's brother. Plus he's been dead for like a million years or something. Martin Chatwin killed him.
Or, Janet said, maybe he didn't.
Or he came back to life or something.
Why hasn't Elliot come back?
Poppy said.
That I don't know. I'm a little peeved about it myself. A little worried, too. I've become quite attached to our High King. Maybe there's something more interesting going on Earth, but I can't imagine what.
Josh?
How does Elliot send you letters?
Oh, we rigged it up before he left. They sort of float to the surface in that little gazing pool in the courtyard outside my bedroom on these strips of paper. It's very picturesque. Then you dry them out and the words develop like a Polaroid.
Poppy?
Should we do it? Should we try to find Imba? I mean, Umber? Sorry, I get them mixed up. Baby brain, it's started already. Seriously, we have to get moving with this because I'm almost in the second trimester here. We've got 6 months.
One thing about Poppy, she had a can-do attitude. It was one of the things Janet liked about her. Maybe the only thing. Or she guessed Poppy's hair was all right, too.
But hang on, Josh said. What if we do find Umber? What do we do with him? I mean, you gotta figure he's pretty far up the power scale. It's not like we're going to intimidate him.
Well, I've been thinking about that, Janet said.
Maybe we stick him in Ember's tomb. Martin managed to trap Ember in there once, and he couldn't get out. Seems to me that thing is like a ready-made, purpose-built Ram God containment facility.
But it's risky, Poppy said. Could we even get him in there? Maybe this is all a little precipitous?
Just then, Janet was overcome by the strangest sensation. She felt herself pulled ever so slightly to one side, her whole body like she was starting to lose her balance.
Then the room gave a little bump and jostle, and the feeling was gone again. It affected the others, too. She could see it.